Welcome to tonight's General Interest Seminar. The speaker tonight is Professor Ian Chipsey from Oxford. Ian did his undergraduate at QM in London, and then about 30 years ago, I guess, he was a graduate student here in this building and working with the likes of Alan, who is here, Ken Peach, and I know who else was around at the time. On CIPI violation. He then went to the US and he has been for many years the Julian Schwinger Distinguished Professor at Purdue University, and he worked on experiments such as Clio and CMS. He was the CMS chairperson of the collaboration board. Since a few years he's now a professor at the University of Oxford. And he's, amongst many other accolades, he's also an APS fellow. One thing, when I got to know Ian, which is about 20 years ago, he was deaf, and his talk will be about this. So thanks, Ian.
Thank you. So first let me check you can actually hear me. Can you hear me? Because obviously I can't hear myself as well as you can hear me, I hope. So, okay, good. If I get too soft, do throw something at me to get my attention. So in October 1989, I had perfect hearing. But by the end of that year, I had no hearing whatsoever. It began when I could not hear the quiet passages of music on a car radio. That day, turning up the volume helped, but soon there was no more music. At the same time, the voices of friends and of family receded, and I entered a world of silence. The reason for my deafness was a medically necessary dose of ototoxic antibiotics that destroyed the hair cells in my cochlea. The reason for the antibiotics was that earlier that year I had contracted acute myelogenous leukemia, a truly terrible form of cancer. But thanks to friends at Syracuse, Purdue, and especially at Cornell, I received first-rate medical care at the Cornell University Medical College in New York City. An industrial-strength dose of chemotherapy beat the cancer, but it left me without an immune system, and the antibiotics protected me until my own immune system had returned. For those who could once hear, deafness is a truly terrible disability. You can read of many cases of people who, in such a condition, withdraw from society, become depressed, and without an appropriate support network, turn to substance abuse and to suicide. For the majority of citizens who lose hearing as they age, studies show they leave the workforce years earlier than they otherwise would do, and from then on lead less fulfilling and productive lives. Children who are born deaf can often fare worse. Sent to schools with children who can hear, they lack the ability to develop an oral linguistic tradition. They leave school at the age of 18 with the reading age of a 12-year-old, and that is a gap that is too large to close. But fortunately, science and engineering are coming to the rescue to treat many forms of deafness, and in this talk, I would like to tell you about one of those forms, the cochlear implant. So the outline of the talk, I'll begin by looking at the physiology of natural hearing, and then the causes for why we cannot hear. More than 10% of our citizens cannot hear well. I look at the solutions for hearing loss, focusing on the cochlear implant, briefly mention some of the political and social issues that surround this technology, before looking at the future of the device. So sound, as you know, is a form of mechanical energy. When we strike a tuning fork, the oscillatory motion of the tines gives rise to oscillatory motion in nearby air molecules. And they in turn transmit that motion to other more distant air molecules. And in this way, sound passes through the air as a molecular disturbance until it arrives at our pia, or ear flap. And what happens next is truly remarkable. And I would like to show you this using a video that was written by a friend of mine. The video is called Auditory Transduction. And it's by a medical illustrationist called Brandon Pletch from Georgia. He was about 23 when he wrote this video. And way back in 2003, it won first prize in the NSF AAAS Science and Engineering Visualization Challenge. And so the sound arrives at our pina, which funnels it down onto the ear canal, and from there to the eardrum, that's about a centimeter across. The eardrum, also called the tympanic membrane. And the tympanic membrane vibrates in response to the sound. Now, the tympanic membrane itself is conical in shape, and it is articulated by three small bones collectively called the ossicles: the malleus or hammer, the incus or anvil, and the stapes or foot plate. These are the three smallest bones in the human body, with the stapes about the size of a grain of rice. And it is through the ossicles that the vibrations of the tympanic membrane are transmitted to the stapes. Now the stapes moves with a piston-like action at the oval window of the bony labyrinth. The bony labyrinth, several centimeters across, is filled with a fluid similar to cerebral spinal fluid. It's sodium-rich, and it's shown here in purple. Now, fluid is relatively incompressible, and so the piston-like action would be ineffective, as shown here, if it was not possible to preserve the volume of the fluid. And so that volume preservation is achieved by having a second membrane, the round window, which moves in synchrony with the stapes at the oval window, and in this way the fluid volume is preserved and the energy can enter the structure. Now the bony labyrinth itself consists of two parts: on the left, the semicircular organ of balance, on the right, the snail-shaped cochlea. The vibrations from the stapes are drawn into the helical structure, where they arise to its apex and then descend to the round window. In more detail, this cochlea consists of two principal ducts called scalae. The vibrations rise to the apex in the scalae vestibuli, and they descend in the scalae tympani. Each of these scalae is about a millimeter across. And there's a third duct, or scalae, called the cochlear duct, and that's full of a potassium-rich solution. And the whole cochlea is extremely small. It's about the size of a chickpea. And the reason it's so small is so that it can be light. And if it's light, it becomes sensitive to low levels of vibration, which correspond to soft sounds. And it forms early. On the right is the excised human cochlea in a child at 5 months gestation. At birth, the cochlea is fully formed and fully functional. Now, if we increase the magnification further, the scalae are separated from the cochlear duct by two membranes, Reiser's membrane and the basilar membrane. And these two membranes are flexible. And so when the vibrations pass through the fluid of the scalae, they cause the membranes to flex. And on the lower of these two membranes, on the basilar membrane, there's a specialized organ called the organ of Corti, and that's shown here in green. And when this organ is stimulated, it produces electricity that passes to the brain along the auditory nerve that fills the hollow modiolus of the cochlea and innervates it upon its entire 35 millimeter helical length. And the origin of these specialized, of these electrical signals are specialized cells called hair cells, inner hair cells and three rows of outer hair cells. They're built off of the basilar membrane and are closely covered by a gelatinous membrane, shown in green. And when the basilar membrane vibrates in response to sound, cilia atop the hair cells are deflected, causing the hair cells to trigger and fire. And so the hair cells are mechano-electrical transducers, and we have about 3,500 inner hair cells and around 12,500 outer hair cells in each of our healthy cochlea. Now the basilar membrane is a frequency analyzer. It does not respond simultaneously to sound. Instead, it responds variably. The apex of the basilar membrane resonates at low frequencies of sound, and the base of the basilar membrane resonates at high frequencies of sound. And so this frequency analysis is referred to as tonotopic organization. And this on the right is a tonotopic map of the human cochlea showing the frequencies at which it resonates. Where the basilar membrane is small and stiff, the resonant frequency is around 20 kilohertz. Whereas at the apex, where the basilar membrane is much more massive and much less stiff, the resonant frequency is around 100 hertz. And so, from the motion of air molecules to the collection of those motions in the ear canal and the transmission of those to the tympanic membrane of the eardrum, to the vibrations of the eardrum through the ossicles, to the piston-like action of the stapes, to the displacements of the fluids in the scalae, to the resonant displacement of the basilar membrane, to the deflection of the cilia atop the hair cells, and the production of electricity that passes to the brain along the auditory nerve. It is this sequence of events that gives rise to our auditory perception of the world around us. Now, it won't surprise you to know that physicists have played an extremely large part in understanding how we hear. Helmholtz was the first to recognize that the basilar membrane was a frequency analyzer, and George von Beckerge, the brilliant Hungarian physicist, made the first observations of tonotopic organization in the 1930s, for which he was awarded the 1961 prize in medicine or physiology. And he experimentally measured basilar membrane displacements in human cadavers, and because in those days the only thing available were microscopes, you couldn't see very small basilar membrane displacements corresponding to soft sounds, so he had to use a very loud sound to produce very large basilar membrane displacements, which he then measured. The data is shown on the right. So for each of these graphs, the base of the basilar membrane is on the left and the apex is on the right, and the vertical axis is the displacement. And so when the frequencies are low, the displacement is maximal at the apex, and when the frequencies are high, the displacement maximally moves towards the base of the cochlea. And so this is the experimental evidence for tonotopic organization that got the Nobel Prize in 1961. And remember, this is done in cadavers, and the sounds produced are very loud to render these displacements visible. Now, von Beckerge's findings in human cadavers led to many mechanical models that could reproduce the observed wave shapes that he had found in the 1930s. And so this is a graph where this is the base of the basilar membrane, and the apex would be 36 millimeters this way, so we're going halfway up, and this way is displacement in nanometers. And in response to a 10 kilohertz frequency tone at a soft sound level, just above the hearing perception, this is the displacement that you predict, agreeing with his model. And now if you change the frequency from 10 kilohertz to 20 kilohertz and look at what the models predict, they predict that the displacement should look like this. again in agreement with what von Beckerge had found. But if you look at these two, you can see that there's a very large amount of overlap between 10 kHz and 20 kHz, despite the fact the frequencies are very different indeed. And so what these models predict is that the human will have very poor frequency selectivity. In other words, poor perception of pitch. But this is absolutely not the case. C, middle C, is 256 Hz. C sharp is 5% higher than C. Humans can tell 1/10 the difference between C and C sharp. That's 0.5% of the frequency at 256 Hz. Cannot be explained by a model like this. So in 1945, the maverick astrophysicist Tommy Gold was thinking about hearing. And he thought it was really rather remarkable, A, that we could hear anything at all, because first of all, we knew that the basilar membrane is sitting in a fluid, and the fluid should damp down displacement, making sounds difficult to hear, unless they're incredibly loud, and yet we can hear soft sound. And secondly, it's remarkable that we have this incredible pitch perception, and this model can't explain that. And so he suggested that perhaps the reason for this was that there was an internal amplifier in the system. The internal amplifier would drive the displacements of the basilar membrane so that we could hear soft sounds. And the internal amplifier would also produce excellent frequency selectivity. Now, at the time, these ideas were completely ignored in the physiology community. And the reasons for that were two. One is because Tommy Gold was not a physiologist, he was an astrophysicist. And secondly, because the idea, at least the second of them, that frequency selectivity should be improved, was not understood. So you could say that Tommy Gold's ideas fell on deaf ears. However, now let me explain to you what Tommy Gold's idea was, and it's a very simple idea. The active amplifier improves the frequency selectivity of a mechanical system and makes it fine-tuned. So the example here is one that we've all experienced. Think of a playground swing. A swing has a natural frequency given by the length of the ropes. In the first case, a child sits passively on the swing, and the mother pushes the child. The mother can do relatively little work to push the swing at its natural frequency, or she can do much more work to push the swing at other than the natural frequency. This is a poorly tuned system. The mother is the amplifier in this case. But now, if you remove the mother from the picture altogether, and remember when you were a child alone in a playground, just remember that time. Shut your eyes and remember it right now. And you're sitting on that swing, and you kick your legs in time with the swing. The vibrations of the amplitude of the swing becomes enormous, very quickly. But if you kick your legs out of time with the swing stops. The swing has become a highly tuned system, supporting only one frequency, and the reason is because the internal mechanism is driving the swing, not an external mechanism. And this was Tommy Gold's idea. So, in the 1980s, it became possible for the first time to actually measure the response of a human or any other cochlear to a low level of sound. And what you can see is this. This is what you get. These modern measurements are in disagreement with the measurements that were taken by von Beckerge. You can see that the displacements are much larger, so that even though the sound is very soft, the displacement is very large. And you can see how narrow that peak is. And if I showed you 20 kilohertz, that would be a narrow peak here. And so you now have a system that is able to detect frequencies and differentiate one from another very effectively. So this is very different. And the reason for this difference is because of the internal amplifier that was predicted by Tommy Gold. And so there's an amplifier, it hadn't yet been found, within the organ of Corti that increases the displacement of the basilar membrane and provides excellent frequency selectivity, excellent perception of pitch. And this amplifies just like the child on the swing. Now, you can see this data another way. This is a plot. And the plot is basilar membrane displacement in nanometers on this axis. And on this axis is sound. Soft sounds produce small displacements and loud sounds produce large displacements. And this is von Beckerge's model. He measured only very loud sounds for which he got big displacements. And they agree with modern data. However, when you project down what von Beckerge should have seen for softer and softer sounds, which for him were not measurable, you get this curve, and the data gives you this. And so this is the evidence for the amplification. And it completely disagrees with von Beckerje. And so you can ask the question, should von Beckerje have got the Nobel Prize in 1961? Well, it turns out that there's an interesting answer to that. These measurements are made on guinea pigs, literally guinea pigs. And to do them, you have to open up the cochlea and see the basilar membrane displace and measure that displacement. And that's a very unpleasant thing to have to happen to if you're a guinea pig. And sometimes when you're on the table there being operated on, you die. And if you die, but the doctor continues to take data, what you find is that the data points move down onto the curve that von Beckerje had had all those years earlier. And so von Beckerje was not wrong. He was in fact right. He was a pioneer of biophysics. He got the results he did because he made his measurements on cadavers. The living ear is a different thing to the dead ear. The living ear has an active amplifier, but the dead ear does not. So then what causes that amplification? So this is a high mag image of the basilar membrane in a chinchilla, but it's similar in a human. And these are inner hair cells, and these are three rows of outer hair cells. The inner hair cells are afferent, that means signals are going to the brain from each of them. But the outer hair cells are sparsely innervated. This is a typical inner hair cell, about 30 microns in length, with the hair cells hair atop and clearly visible. And in more detail, each hair is about 500 nanometers across, and they're joined by fibrous actin strands about 10 nanometers in diameter called tip links. When the sound causes the basilar membrane to displace, the hair cells are deflected and the tip links open trapdoors in the walls of the cell. The potassium-rich solution in the cochlear duct flows into the cells. The cells are like batteries, they're highly polarized, and the arrival of the potassium current rapidly depolarizes a cell, and then through a sequence of complex chemical steps, neurotransmitters are released at the base of the cell, and we eventually hear sound. And both the inner and outer hair cells work in this way. So now the inner hair cells are sending signals to the brain that we're interpreting as sound. So what are the outer hair cells doing? And so I want to show you a movie that was made a very long time ago by the BBC. And this is an outer hair cell that's about 70 microns in length. And we're going to play some music to a microphone. The microphone is attached to an electrode. And so when the music passes through the microphone, an electric current will come out of the microphone and it will go into the electrode and then into the cell. And that electric current will be modulated by the amplitude and the tempo of the music. So watch. 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're going to rock. Around 6 o'clock tonight, so the first thing you should remember is the next time you dance to the music, it's not just you that's dancing, it's 12,500 outer hair cells and 3,500 inner hair cells in each of your healthy cochlea. So you see that contraction, that's electromotility, the phenomenon of electromotility, discovered in the 1980s. And so what happens is this, the sound comes in and causes the basilar membrane to be displaced. The outer hair cell cilia are deflected and the potassium current rushes into them. And this causes these outer hair cells to contract like springs. When they contract, because they're attached to the basilar membrane here, they pull the basilar membrane up and make the displacements larger than they otherwise would be. And this means that even the softest sound, corresponding to even the smallest displacement, is going to cause a deflection of the inner hair cell cilia, and then the production of the neurotransmitters that pass through the brain, and we hear sound. And so the outer hair cells are the mechanical amplifiers. They contract during the transduction, just to repeat myself, enhancing the basilar membrane displacement, increasing the sensitivity to soft sound, and improving our ability to perceive pitch. And so that's all there is to how we hear. So that's how we hear, but these are five reasons why we don't always hear. The first is genetic. The second is infection, such as bacterial meningitis, a rubella. The third is exposure to acute or chronic very loud sound, which can take the hair cells beyond their elastic limit and physically break them. The fourth are prescription drugs such as ototoxic antibiotics, quite common ones, and also some chemotherapeutic agents as well. And the fifth is simply as we age, the hair cells wear out and they break. And that last one affects 10% of all citizens. It's a very serious problem. So the main types of hearing loss are actually two. One is conductive hearing loss. What that means is that the hammer, the anvil, or the stapes, or some combination of them, are broken. And so that's a mechanical problem. The vibrations of the tympanic membrane are not getting to your cochlea. And so you can repair that surgically. But far more common is what in many countries is called nerve deafness, but that's a misnomer. It's not the nerve that's dead, it's the hair cells that are missing. Sensory neural hearing loss, loss of hair cells. That affects almost all the people that lose hearing, including hearing as we age. In the vast majority of cases, we lose some of the hair cells. And so we experience a mild or moderate hearing loss because there's still some left to transduce the sound and pass it to the brain. And the way to deal with that is hearing aids. Hearing aids simply make sounds louder. And so if you make a sound louder, that means the stapes will move more than before, so more energy will be put into the cochlea, and so even though there are less transducers, you're compensating for the lack of, for fewer transducers by adding more energy to the system. But then, in about 4% of all cases, something else happens. You have a large number of hair cells that have died or somehow been destroyed. In that case, hearing aids are not going to help. Because it doesn't matter how loud the sound is, there's no transducers to turn that sound into electrical signals that the brain can process. And it's for this class of hearing loss that the cochlear implant is sometimes a solution. So it may surprise you to know that the cochlear implant is not a new idea. The first cochlear implant was developed in 1800 by the very distinguished physicist, chemist, and everyman scientist, Volta. And of course, Volta also invented the battery. And when you invent something, you want to try it out. And so Volta placed two metallic probes into both ears and connected the ends of the two probes to a 50-volt battery. And he observed that, and this is a direct quote, "At the moment when the circuit was completed, I received a shock in the head, and some moments after, I began to hear a sound, or rather a noise in the ears, which I cannot well define. It was a kind of a crackling with shocks, as if some paste or tenacious matter had been boiling." They wrote beautifully in those days, don't you think? He went on to say, "The disagreeable sensation, which I believe might be dangerous because of the shock in the brain, prevented me from repeating the experiment." And this is a true story, and that's the reference. You can check it. It's not on the archive, though. So now let's go forward 200 years to the modern cochlear implant. So unlike a hearing aid that makes sound louder, a cochlear implant is going to bypass completely the non-functional hair cells and produce weak electrical signals that will be passed directly to the auditory nerve. So it is not a hearing aid. It does not make sounds louder. So I'd like to talk you through the parts of a cochlear implant before we discuss how they really work. And so first the sounds are picked up by a microphone, and the microphone is just like the microphone in a hearing aid and turned into an electrical signal. Now, that's shown here, and I'm actually wearing one of these at the moment, so if I can get close enough, you might be able to see it. My cochlear implant is above my left pina. Maybe you can see that, can you? And I'll take it off for a second, so now I can't hear anything. So this is, although it's an implant, 50% of it is outside your head, right? So the other half is inside, and I can't show you that bit. So, after the microphone, the next stage is to take that signal and start processing it. And so that happens with an application-specific integrated circuit that performs a spectral analysis of the sound. which basically means to determine the frequencies and the amplitude and then store that information digitally. The next stage is to take the digital information and send it to a coil antenna that will transmit that radio wave that's modulated with the digital information through the skin to the inside. Now, in my case, the coil antenna is not above my left pina, as shown here, but it's actually on the other side of my head. And if you want to know why that is, you can ask at the end. After that, once we've got the radio wave sending that information through the skin, point four is another application-specific integrated circuit with a receiver. So it picks up the radio wave and takes the digital information, and from that digital information turns it back into analog information about which frequencies we had and how loud they were, and then produces a series of pulses. So it's also a pulse generator, and it was now going to send those pulses along an electrical wire to the cochlea. And then the auditory nerve, which is number five, will pick up the electrical signals and pass them to the brain. And then the brain recognizes the signals as sound. And I should say that in this picture, the brain is not to scale. Okay, so this is a very old drawing of a cochlear implant from the 1980s, in the days when they were much bigger. But it's the same basic idea: microphone, speech processor, then the transmitter, this is the skin, and then this is parts inside you, the receiver and the electrode array. Now, in natural hearing, as I showed you earlier, the high frequency sounds stimulate the cochlea at its base, and the low frequency sounds stimulate the cochlea at its apex. And so the key idea with the cochlear implant is to exploit that tonotopic organization of our natural physiology to do the... What happened here? Oh, it wants to update the time machine, you know. There we go. Let's see if we can get this back. Okay. So next time I should turn off the software that asked me if I updated my Mac before I give the talk. So what we're going to do is we're going to use the tonotropic organization. And so we want to give information to the auditory nerve, sort it by frequency, and then deliver it to the place in the auditory nerve that in the natural physiology it would have responded to. And so we do that by having a sequence of electrodes that carry the different frequencies. Different devices have different numbers, between 10 and 22 typically. And then the speech processor is continuously measuring and sorting the sound as it comes in by pitch and by loudness. And the high frequency sounds that it gets is going to send to electrodes at the cochlear base, and the low frequency sounds that it receives, it will send to electrodes at the cochlear apex. And so we're helping the brain by sorting the sound for it and presenting it to the auditory nerve in the same way as the natural physiology, as best as we are able. And so this is a modern multi-electrode cochlear implant in the scala tympani, within light green, the auditory nerve. And each of these rectangles is an electrode. And when they pulse white, that means that that's actually carrying an electrical current at that time. And you see that the pulsing is interleaved. In my device, 18,800 pulses per second are presented to my auditory nerve. Now, cochlear implants have improved dramatically over the last 20 years. This is a graph of sentence recognition in implantees versus year and type of device. So in 1980, the first commercial cochlear implant came out, built by the 3M Corporation, and it had a single electrode. And this enabled sound to be perceived, but not to be comprehended. And the reason was because there was no frequency information. But by the late 1990s, there were multi-electrode cochlear implants exploiting the tonotopic organization of the human cochlea, and then with various speech coding strategies to get that information to the auditory nerve, the devices proved very efficacious. And sentence recognition rose in many cases to 80%. Now, I hadn't got a cochlear implant myself in 1996, but I was deaf. And the reason that I hadn't got one was because in those days it was known that the cochlear implant success rate was not very high. The results varied widely. And then in 2001, I was at a conference at Caltech, and a good friend of mine, Andreas Kronfeld, who's a very well-known lattice gauge theorist, and many of you may know him here because of your big lattice gauge group at Edinburgh. And Andreas told me that his brother-in-law was deaf and had a cochlear implant and was doing well with it. So I spoke to Andreas's brother-in-law, got to meet him, and he told me that the cochlear implant had changed his life. And so it was at that point that I decided to learn more about the device. And so the first thing is, who exactly can have a cochlear implant? So this slide applies to the US, but it's actually very similar in Western Europe as well. So first, you sort people into adult or child. So let's talk about adults. Adult here means more than 18 years of age. But there's no limitation by age. You can be 90 years of age and benefit from a cochlear implant. You need to be bilaterally, moderately to profoundly sensory neuro deaf, with little or very little benefit from state-of-the-art hearing aids in an extended trial. In the United States, about 1 million citizens qualify for a cochlear implant. 71,000 citizens actually have one, with a very large fraction of the eligible children having them and a very small fraction of the eligible adults, about 7%. Now, you need to be psychologically suitable. At the time I was being interviewed as a candidate for this device, I was lip reading, and they said no psychotics, and I thought they said no physicists. And you have to have no anatomic or medical contraindication. Now, if you meet all those requirements, there's then a very extensive audiological and medical testing, because it has to demonstrate to the insurance companies that you truly are deaf. And then you have CT scans, MRI, and so on, and then you get to, if you pass all of that, you get to choose a device you would like implanted. There's three main companies: Cochlear, Med-El, and Clarion. My device is a Med-El. My device was implanted in the United States, but made in Vienna. All these devices have very similar performance, and the biggest variable in the outcome is the patient. And then you have to wait for the surgery, and that can be many, many months. And finally, the surgery day arrives. And this is a cochleostomy. That's a hole made in the round window, and the electrode is placed into the scarlet tympani, and a postage stamp recess is carved in the mastoid bone to hold the receiver, stimulator, and a magnet. After the surgery, which is a major surgery, 2 to 4 hours under general anesthesia, the fortunate fact is that the complication rate is low. It's less than 5%. There can be wound infection or breakdown, but that normally resolves itself. There is a very tiny risk of a facial nerve injury, because the cochleostomy is performed just 1 millimeter or so from the facial nerve. If the facial nerve were transected, it would not regrow. It would lead to permanent facial paralysis. That would be a tragedy for the patient. It would be a tragedy for the surgeon as well. There's the possibility of vertigo, because the bony labyrinth also includes the organ of balance, but that usually resolves itself as well. And there's also the more mundane possibility of a hardware failure, that the device is put in and it breaks. The strategy for that is to take it out and put a new one in. And after that, you have to avoid MRI, because now you have a magnet in your head. The reason you have a magnet in your head is to hold the receiver stimulator in close proximity to the transmitter to have efficacious transmission of the sound information. And now you have to wait. And you have to wait about 8 weeks for the wound to heal before the device can actually be turned on, and hopefully you'll get to hear sound. And at least in the US, while you're waiting, you wonder how to pay the medical bill. So the cost, and of course these costs apply to the US, although the costs aren't so very different in other and socialized medical systems either. They're just paid for in different ways. So the CI actually costs in the US somewhere between $60,000 and $100,000. That includes the evaluation, the surgery, the post-operative hospital care, and the rehabilitation. The Medicaid and Medicare system in the US has paid total or partial cost in the past. Some private insurers refuse to cover the devices, others provide excellent coverage. This is a quote: the reimbursement levels have forced 8 hospitals to close CI programs because of the cost of subsidizing the implants. Obviously, some of the people that receive these implants come from lower for families without money. And there has to be some way to pay for them and enable that to happen in the US. And so it's been done by subsidizing. Other hospitals ration services by putting children on waiting lists. Of the 45,000 children that have that could qualify and benefit from a cochlear implant, 28,000 did have one by 2010. That number's slightly higher today, but not much. And about 7% of adults have a cochlear implant in the US. The fraction of people that have implants in the United Kingdom is very similar to the US. And yet the cost of a CI, you know, is actually very small. $100,000 is small compared to the cost in government aid and education, estimated by the US government at more than $1 million over the course of a lifetime for someone that is deaf. And that's not to mention the incredible personal cost of going through life deaf in a world in which most people can hear. Another quote, ultimately this is about the way society views hearing. Being deaf is not going to kill you, and so the insurance companies do not view this as necessary. So I was one of the lucky ones. The cost of my implant was covered through my university position. Now, it's also the case that we don't yet know, under the new Obamacare, what will happen with cochlear implants. We don't know whether it will improve the access or not. We hope it will. Okay, so in my case then, the activation day arrived. Now, I had been operated on at Indiana University by a very famous surgeon in November, early November of 2002. And we hadn't told anyone back home in the UK about what we were going to do, because we wanted it to be a nice surprise that I could come home for Christmas and meet my family and they could find that I'd suddenly got my hearing back. That was the plan. So we were very disappointed to learn that the activation date was set for mid-January. So this was really a disappointment. But then, 2 days before we were coming back to Europe, my wife had a telephone call from the hospital and they said that there had been a cancellation and so there was an opening. And it would be possible to accelerate the activation of Ian if he wanted it. So of course I wanted it. And so the next 2 days later I drove to the hospital. I go into a large, very high-tech audiology clinic at the hospital. And I'm attached to a PC whilst various tests are done, including choosing the frequency ranges for the filters that make up the ASIC, and also checking the connectivity of the device. And during this time you hear absolutely nothing. And I say hooked up to a PC advisedly because I'm not Mac compatible. I actually crash a Mac. And this device, you're sitting there and they're probing you and you hear absolutely nothing. And the whole time you're sitting there you're wondering whether you're going to hear. And after a while you become very impatient because now a whole hour has passed. And so far you've heard absolutely nothing. And so at that moment the audiologist turned to me and I was still lip-reading and she said that we're almost ready now to turn the device on. Please understand that you have been deaf for 12 years. And so the chances that you will hear are actually very, very small. If you're very, very lucky, you will hear something, but it will be very indistinct sounds. Very difficult to understand. And if you're extremely lucky, you might just be able to understand what I'm saying to you. So she went back to her PC and continued to do a few more tests. And then I became very impatient. And so I said to her, have you turned on this device yet? And before I'd got to the end of that sentence, I realized I'd heard my own voice for the first time in 12 years. And that evening I got back to my home and I heard my wife's voice for the first time in 12 years. And because my daughter was born after I'd become deaf, I got to hear my daughter's voice for the first time ever. And there's really no words in the English language to explain just how wonderful all of that was. But that is the power of the cochlear implant. That is the power of physics and engineering to improve the human condition. So how well does my device work? This is an audiogram, very similar to one you may have had at some point in your life. And this axis is sound. These are soft sounds, and down here is loud sound, and this is frequency, low frequency and high frequency. And this is the normal hearing threshold of a human, in green. This is my hearing before the cochlear implant. I had a hearing threshold of 100 decibels, which means that if you're standing on the runway, you'll just about hear the jumbo jet. And this is my performance 6 months after the cochlear implant was turned on. And this is the type of curve that somebody who's about 50 years of age would have naturally in many cases. It's called mildly hard of hearing. And so it's a dramatic improvement. And my hearing has continued to improve since that time. These are speech tests performed before the operation and after the operation. In the easier tests, I went from 0% to almost 100%. You know, it's kind of embarrassing to be a physics professor and get 0% on a test. Now, at the time, my test scores were considered to be extremely good. However, the good news is that today, 75% of postlingually deaf patients with state-of-the-art cochlear implants can use the telephone. In other words, this kind of performance is no longer rare. But the question then becomes, why does this device work so well? You saw in the first part of this talk the incredible, exquisite beauty and efficacy of natural physiology of hearing. And then you saw that we have a device made of a silicon chip with 8, 10, 12, 20 electrodes. How come something so simple can restore hearing? So the reason that this happens is because hearing doesn't end at the cochlea, that's merely where it begins. Perception, whether it's visual perception or auditory perception, is a dynamic combination of two things, top-down processing and bottom-up processing. For example, if you see a shape in the distance, and that shape is very distinctive and very familiar, you don't actually need much detail to know what it is. So if you see a huge grey animal in the distance, you don't need much detail to know it is an elephant, for example. So I'd like to give you some visual examples of the power of top-down processing. So the first thing I'd like to do is show you something. I'll show you a person. The person is famous. I'm not going to show you much information about the person, though. And you'll probably be able to recognize who this person is. And if you can, the reason you can do that is because they're using top-down processing more than bottom-up processing. So see if you know who this person is. Do you know? Famous American?
Lincoln.
Yes, that's right, Lincoln. Now, not everyone recognized Lincoln right away. Some of you are either more familiar with this image, it's on the web, very easy to find. Some of you maybe live in America. In America, when I give this talk, everyone knows that's Lincoln right away. But England's probably the country where the largest fraction know that after America. So that's Lincoln. Let me show you a bit more information so that Lincoln comes more clearly into view. You see now? Looking more like Lincoln, yes? Out of curiosity, how many of you cannot see Lincoln at this point? Okay, good, you can all see it. That actually, there's still very little information here. Let me add more. Look, and more. So you did a really good job. You used top-down processing to understand that that was Lincoln. Now, the language equivalent of that is a missing word in a well-known phrase. For example, if I say, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United of America, although I didn't say it, everyone knows that the missing word is states. You know that by context. You know that by top-down processing. And that's exactly how a postlingually deaf person hears with a cochlear implant. Cochlear implants do not give you every word. They do not correspond to natural hearing. However, because of our familiarity with language, our knowledge of context, and the like, we can use our top-down processing to fill in the blanks. So top-down processing is key to the efficacy of a cochlear implant. So now let me take away your ability to use top-down processing. I want to show you an image that you've all seen before, but you're much less familiar with it, and it's much less distinctive. So I ask you to tell me, what is this? Do you know? It's easy, right? Anyone know? Okay, let me show you a bit more information. Any idea? You want to guess? A bit more?
It's money.
What?
It's money.
No, but that's not a bad guess, though. It's not a bad guess. Here it comes. I think you're going to see it in a minute. Look, it starts to look familiar, no?
Sistine Chapel.
There you go, look. It's the disintegration of the persistence of memory by Dali. Everyone has seen this picture before. But you could not recognize it because you could not use top-down processing. Because it's not familiar enough. And so you became powerless. Before you were fully in control, you recognized Lincoln, no sweat. Now this is much harder. So the language equivalent of that is missing words in a phrase you've never heard before, or a phrase in a language you do not know, or language heard for the first time through a cochlear implant. And that's exactly the situation a prelingually deaf person is when they're given a cochlear implant, in other words, a child. And so an adult using a cochlear implant is like recognizing Lincoln, as long as he's postlingually deaf. A child using a cochlear implant is like recognizing the Dali picture. Much harder. So, here is a photograph. The top photograph is a picture of a word. The axis is frequency here, low frequency to high frequency, and this axis is time. And the word is choice. And this is color-coded, so that white is the loudest part of the sound. And as you all know, choice has three parts to it. This is ch. This is the oi piece of the word, and this is the s at the end. And that's actually what it would look like if you could take a photograph of the word choice. And down here is exactly the same word, except this time the output of the cochlear implant instead of the sound. And so instead of having frequency here, we now have electrodes representing from low frequencies to high. There's only a small number of electrodes. And this is still time. And you can see that this pattern is similar to that. But is it similar enough to actually recognize the word choice? So we can ask the question, how do we optimize the cochlear implant to maximize speech recognition? So we need to know, what is it about the information that we get from the cochlea that the brain uses to actually recognize the words? So one thing you could imagine is amplitude, how loud things are. But the fact is that whether I speak to you with a very loud voice or whether I speak to you with a medium loud voice, you'll still understand me. As long as I'm audible, you understand. Amplitude is not important, as long as you have enough amplitude. A second thing that could be important is the temporal structure of sound. This would correlate with the pulse rate of the implant. But just like when you watch a movie, as long as the frames are passing quickly enough, you're unaware that you're not actually watching motion. It's the same with a cochlear implant. As long as we pulse at many thousands of times a second, we're unaware that the sound is coming as a burst of pulses. And so the temporal structure is not important either. What actually is the most important thing is the number of locations at which the auditory nerve is stimulated and the places on the auditory nerve that you produce that stimulation. And that correlates with the tonotopic organization that was discovered by von Beckerge. And so I'm going to show you that and let you hear what it's like to hear with a cochlear implant. And so first I'd like to take a sentence in English and put that into a cochlear implant, but with only one electrode. And so that means that the presence or absence of the sound, the louder or softer parts, will be relayed as louder or softer sounds, but without frequency information. It'll all be in one frequency. And so this will be a bit like Volta's experiment. And so tell me what you think this sentence is when you hear it. Anyone know? The reason you didn't know, of course, is because you can't use your top-down processing here. You're forced. You have no idea what that sentence is. This is bottom-up. And with just one channel, there's not enough information to deduce what it could be. Now, that's one channel. Now let's go to two channels. So two channels simply means that I'm going to take all the sound and I'm going to divide it into low frequencies or high frequencies. All the low frequency sounds will go to the apex of the cochlea, the high frequency sounds to the base. And that's all we'll do, sort the sound by high and low. It should sound different to you than before. Tell me if you understand it's the same sentence, what this is. Any idea? Okay, let's go to four. So now with four channels, that's simply four frequency bands, four bandpass filters in the cochlear implant. Again, it should sound different to you than before. And tell me if you know what this is. You might get it this time. It's starting to sound like a human voice, right? Does anyone know what it is? Okay. Let's go to eight. Now, before I play eight, I should tell you that I have eight channels. Okay. So I think now some of you will understand at eight channels. I actually have 10, but two are broken. That's why I have eight. Okay, so here we go with eight channels. And listen carefully and tell me if you know what this is.
I like to play chess.
I like to play tennis.
Yes. Very good. I like to play tennis. That's great. At eight channels. Now some of you could do it at eight channels and some couldn't. So some of you are maybe a bit more relaxed. more happy to go with the top-down flow and not worry too much about getting it wrong. It's partly a psychological thing. But now, let's play the original, so you hear the difference between 8 and the original.
I like to play tennis.
Dramatically different, right? Now, I should tell you a couple of things here. First thing is that, for me, 8 channels and the original sound exactly the same. They sound different to you, not to me. They're exactly the same to me because I only have 8 channels, so I don't gain anything when I go to all the channels. But the second thing to tell you about that is that, remarkably, despite the fact that the 8 channel thing sounded horribly, probably robotic to you, it doesn't mean that I live in a world where everybody sounds like a robot. Now, the reason for that is that I remember how people sounded from before, and so I just use my memory of voice. And every cochlear implantee does this. And so we posit nice human sounds on top of the robotic sounds, and then we're unaware of the robotic sounds. So that's a remarkable thing in itself. But now, here's another thing. Many of you could not recognize with 8 channels what was being said, but now you've heard what is being said because you've heard the original. So this means that now when you listen to 8 channels again, you know, you can actually use your top-down processing to render the 8 channels into something intelligible and possibly even quite pleasant. So now listen to 8 channels again.
I like to play tennis.
You see? It's much easier now. The top-down processing makes the difference. Now you can see this another way. This is a graph of perception and sentences correct versus the number of channels. And so what we did here is we take a group of cochlear implantees and they have a certain number of electrodes, but we turn them off. And with just one on, they find it very hard to understand anything. But as we gradually turn on more and more channels, once you get to about 8 or so, they plateau and understand rather well. And so this is the most important factor of speech recognition, the number of spectral channels of information. Now, it still takes time to learn how to understand the information coming through the cochlear implant. It's not fast. And so this is a curve of time versus perception of sound and its comprehension. And these are 29 patients. Before the operation, this was their comprehension, and this is how it changed with time. And so over the course of 6 months, they learn how to understand sound with a cochlear implant. And this is a nice demonstration of the plasticity of the adult brain. All of the adults in this study, though, were postlingually deaf. So they had the advantage of being able to use their top-down processing to help them fill in the gaps. What about children, then? What about prelingually deaf children? How do they fare? And this is where the device has been controversial. So these comments refer to the deaf community and cochlear implants in the United States, but they're probably applicable also to the United Kingdom. And so most of you probably know people that are truly deaf. And people that are truly deaf can lead extremely full and satisfying lives without emphasizing speech, if they are part of the deaf, uppercase D, deaf community, where sign language is the key way of communicating. Reading is important, but speaking is less so. So in the 1990s, there was very strong opposition in the deaf community to pediatric implantation, while there was a general neutrality towards adult implantation. The argument was that if you implant the child, you'll delay the deaf child's acquisition of sign language, which is their natural language, and their assimilation into the deaf community. In fact, in 1991, the National Association for the Deaf in the United States had a position statement that said that they deplore the government's decision to approve pediatric implantation because it is unsound, scientifically, procedurally, and ethically. It was a very strong stance against the device. Today, however, the deaf community tend to regard cochlear implantation as a personal decision. This is a statement from 2000. Where they say that we emphasize taking advantage of technological advances that have the potential to improve the quality of life for deaf and hard of hearing persons, and we strongly support the development of the whole child and of language and of literacy. So this is an example of the language development in profoundly deaf children with a cochlear implant. And so this is a graph of language age versus natural age for a hearing child, which is this line here. When a child is of 48 months age, their language age is also 48 months. And the closed and open circles are children who are deaf and have not yet been implanted. And you can see that their natural age greatly exceeds their language age, as you would expect. Now, the children of the black circles are children that will be implanted, and the open circles are the control group. And so then the children, 23 of them, were implanted, and this is their average performance at 3 times after the implant compared to the average performance they are predicted to have had if they hadn't been implanted based on the control group. And you can see that they're acquiring language at a much accelerated rate. So to quote the paper, despite a large amount of individual variability, the best performers in the implanted group seem to be developing an oral linguistic system based largely on auditory input from a cochlear implant. Now, it should be stressed that these children are in very supportive environments where they continue to use sign language and continue to get all kinds of other support, including visual cues. This does not happen if you just leave the child and implant them. It requires a great deal of work. But it's a remarkable outcome. Now, due to the fact that there's only a small number of electrodes, I have 8, a cochlear implantee has rather poor pitch perception, and so it's very difficult to, for example, enjoy music. At the same time, it's much easier to understand speech. So I'd like to tell you what music sounds like through a cochlear implant. This is a very famous piece of music. You know it very well, but I'm going to play it to you first as I hear it through the cochlear implant. Isn't that nice? Okay, now I'm going to play you the original. Before I play the original for you, let me tell you that, of course, to me, what you just heard and what you're about to hear, while they sound different to you, sound exactly the same to me. So, dramatically different. But again, in case you think that I live in the world of those horrible sounds of the first recording, I don't. Once I know what the piece of music I'm going to hear is, I can use musical memory to bring back how the sound should be. And most cochlear implantees can do the same. So, how can we improve these devices? The last couple of slides before I finish. The first thing that we can do is we can combine cochlear implants with hearing aids. What this does is that there are many, many people that lose hearing as they age. The hearing that they lose can be brought back for the low frequencies with a hearing aid, because the amount of damage there is not so great. But in the high frequencies, where most of the damage has occurred, that's where the cochlear implant can help. And when you put both in, what you see is the following. This is the person that had only a hearing aid on, couldn't understand anything. When he had only the cochlear implant on, he understood half of what was said to him. But when he had both a cochlear implant and a hearing aid in the same ear, scored 84%. And there are many more examples of that. So that's a very simple way to improve a cochlear implant. The second way is to have 2 cochlear implants instead of 1. And so, when sound is closer to your left ear than your right ear, it will arrive at your left ear before your right ear. It will then be processed by both cochlear and sent on variable length delay lines to the medial superior olive. If the sound arrives at a particular neuron in synchrony from the left ear and the right ear, that neuron fires. If you now move the sound source slightly to the right, the time difference between the arrival at the left ear and the right ear will change. And so a different neuron will see signals in coincidence and that will fire. And it's in this way that humans have been able to tell the direction of the sound to 1 degree in the plane of our ears. However, if you have 1 cochlear implant, this doesn't work very well because the signals are only coming in from one side and not the other, and the neurons never fire. And so with 1 cochlear implant, there's no sense of direction. And so this is demonstrated here. These are 7 people, and they all had 2 cochlear implants. And in the first case and second cases for each of them, we turn off one cochlear implant and then ask them, is the sound on your left or on your right? Of course, their eyes are closed at the time as well. And the answer they give is right half the time. However, when they have both cochlear implants on, they do much, much better, getting almost 100%. And so cochlear implantees can tell the direction of sound to about 16 degrees with bilateral implants. And that's important because knowing where sound comes from could save your life. But there's a second reason, too, why cochlear implants, having two, is good. And that is that we live in a very noisy world. And so here, speech is coming from the front. That's the signal we want to process. The noise is coming from the left, and the person has their cochlear implant on their left ear. And so there's a lot of noise going into this cochlear implant, and so the speech perception is quite poor. If the sound source is from the front and the noise is from the right, but the cochlear implant is on the left, the head creates a shadow that blocks some of the sound, and so the signal to noise improves, and the perception of speech improves. And if you have two cochlear implants, then it doesn't matter where the sound source is relative to the noise source, you'll always understand very well and score almost 100%. Hearing subjects get 100% in all of these tests, however. And another benefit is that there are a number of people that have received one cochlear implant and did not benefit from it. But when the second cochlear implant was added, there was a dramatic improvement. So in addition to those two ways of improving cochlear implants, other work is ongoing, increasing the number of electrodes, providing a greater coverage of the auditory nerve along the cochlea. And these should enable better spectral information to be presented to the auditory nerve. There's a hope, therefore, that there'll be improved speech performance and improved music appreciation. There's work ongoing on reducing the power that the cochlear implant consumes so that the whole device can be placed inside the skull. And because, ultimately, the cochlear implant performance is limited by how many surviving auditory nerve neurons that you actually have, there's a lot of work going on the regeneration of auditory nerve neurons. And so implants enable the postsingually deaf to hear, and they've provided sufficient information to support language development in children, which is a truly remarkable result. Implants have taught us a great deal about speech recognition. We've learned that exploiting the tonotopic organization is the key to the implant's success, and that means how many channels you have and what the frequency assignment of the electrodes is. For music and speech quality, however, including the recognition of male voices versus female voices and accents, that requires the kind of spectral information that the current generation of cochlear implants do not provide, and so there's room for improvement. And so there's some final thoughts. A cochlear implant, it seems to me, is a truly wonderful example of the power of science and engineering, all of the different disciplines listed here, working together inside a tiny package, inside a human being, to improve the human condition. It's one of the great reasons to do science. There are about 220,000 people with a cochlear implant today worldwide. And with the latest devices, about 3/4 of the postlingually deaf adults can actually use the telephone. No visual cues whatsoever. That's remarkable. Even more remarkable, small children can hear their parents' voices for the first time and learn to understand them, learn to hear their parents say, I love you. And that is priceless. So it is critically important that we work to make this technology more widely known and available to all that might benefit from it. Today, far too few people that could benefit from the implant have an opportunity to have one. Now, at a personal level, 11 years ago, I had my hearing restored, and it's enabled me to more easily conduct research and to teach and to hear my wife's voice for the first time in 12 years and my daughter's voice for the first time ever. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Ian. We might have time for a few questions.
So a couple, I'll just ask them together. The first is technology curiosity. I don't think you said much about powering the device. I guess it's reductive, so maybe you've explained it out.
I'm having some trouble hearing you from back there because you're so high up that your sound is bouncing off the walls. One of the things you can't do with a cochlear implant is hear sound that's reflected. And the reason is very simple. If you think of a sound wave and then you reflect it, and then look at the reflected wave, it's dramatically changed from the original wave. So it's a bit like you give me the Lincoln image, but then you scramble Lincoln, and it's really some Lincoln's brother.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's right.
You didn't say much about the power, I didn't think.
No, that's right, I didn't, because that's technical information, 1,800 joules per day.
But how does it get fed in? Inductive?
Oh, so it's on radio frequency.
Right, okay. Yeah. So that's But I was curious from the beginning about the number of electrodes.
Yes.
So you've got 8, and I think you talked
that's
about
right.
20.
That's right.
Where's the R&D for this heading at the moment?
Well, there's lots of devices being developed that have up to 100 or so electrodes. It's not a problem to go to 100, it's a problem to go to the kind of number of electrodes that would correspond to the 3,500 in a hair source. That's much harder, but to go to 100 or so can be done. That's all. In fact, 100 electrode devices have actually been tested in mice. But you can't really ask the mouse, did it sound good?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's still very much at the R&D stage. There's a lot of work, University of Michigan is one area, one place that's doing that work. And a lot of that work involves developing soft electrodes using Kapton thin film technologies and so on to build the electrodes. Similar to the kind of thing we do in particle physics sometimes. Yeah. To answer your question, oh, by the way, on the power, the reason why it's 1,800 joules a day is because this ASIC is executed in 2.5 micron CMOS, yeah, which is actually pretty old-fashioned.
Yeah. I saw the curve, it actually is plateauing when you get more electrodes. So actually this is the law of diminishing returns with the number of electrodes.
Yeah, that's correct.
So actually going, you have to go to a very large number before you start getting...
Right, and it's not simply the number of electrodes, it's exactly where you would have them. You could imagine, for example, that if you had 100 or even 1,000 electrodes and they were all centered within 3 millimeters of the base of the cochlear, of the auditory nerve, that really all you'd have achieved is effectively giving a very faithful representation of the sound between 20 kilohertz and 18 kilohertz. Not very valuable. And so a lot depends on exactly where those electrodes are as well. And you have to be very careful when you think about what's actually happening. You're using a biphasic pulse, so there's no net charge involved, because if you had net charge in your cochlea, you would be doing electrolysis, which would not be a good idea. So this is creating an electric field. The electric field is now propagating to the auditory nerve, but it's very difficult to make sure that that electric field goes exactly where you would like it to go. And once that electric field is there, you now would not wish another electrode very close to it to also be pulsed at the same moment, because then you'd have a second electric field, and the two could interfere in a way that would be difficult to predict. And so you need to ensure that when you're relaying the information, that you choose electrodes that are well separated from each other. So in my device, about 3 or 4 millimeters separates each electrode. And first we say choose electrode number 1, and we stimulate that. Then we choose an electrode that's a long way from number 1, and stimulate that. And then we go to one intermediate between 1 and the one we've just chosen. And this is called interleaved pulsing. And that helps to minimize the electric field interactions. But there's a flip side to this, which is that instead of saying that they're a nuisance, these electric field interactions, you could actually be very clever and use them. For example, if you chose to place an electric field here and another one here, on two electrodes adjacent to each other, what you could, by using the law of the principle of superposition, you can actually choose, you can design what the electric field would be at the point in between those two electrodes, and hence stimulate at another place. That's called virtual electrodes. And that's also an area that's ongoing in research. But yes, the number of electrodes and their placement is critical. And it's not simply a matter of adding more of them, but I'm optimistic that the 100 channel type is something we should see in the next few years.
Andy? A quick, silly question and a more interesting one, I hope. So you mentioned avoiding MRI. How are you with airport security?
Sorry, the question was about MRI.
You mentioned airport avoiding MRI. How are you with airport security?
I'm not sure I followed the question at all.
How are you with airport security?
Oh, a great question. No, I know what you mean when you said that's a silly question, but first, as a professor, you should know there's no such thing as a silly question, right? Okay, so some years ago, back in 2003, when I first had my cochlear implant, if you were seen at an airport, the security people would say, what is that? Get that off right away. They were very worried about what this thing was. And they would assume it was some kind of, you know, high-tech, cool Bluetooth device, maybe. But anyway, you're not supposed to wear that going through the security, so take it off. So I'd explain to them, well, it's a cochlear implant, and I hear with it. And some people had just never seen them at that time. They were still relatively rare, and so you had to carry a special card that would show that you had it. Then I was allowed to go through the machine. But when I went through the machine, I set the machine off. And so every single time I went to the airport, I mean, I'm not good at getting to airports early. And so the net result was that I would end up always being stopped, being searched. I missed planes on two or three occasions just because I had a cochlear implant and it was taking, you know, they had to have many stuff. So now I've gone through the machine and they say, well, we're going to have to do a pat down, but sir, you have to wait 10 minutes because there's a long line. So you quietly wait 10 minutes, your plane's gone in the interim. So yes, it was a challenge, but today it's very different. Today, the cochlear implant is more common, and the staff at airports are trained to recognize cochlear implantees, and it's now smooth sailing. I never take the device off. I don't seem to set the machines off anymore either. So that's great. So now it's really fast. Okay, so that answered your question, the first question, I think. Yeah.
Sorry for hogging again, but I really did want to know the answer to this one. In talking about two implants, you emphasized spatial discrimination.
Yeah.
But to me, and partly from my own experience, I would expect that it makes a big difference to top-down processing, because nearly all real-world sound has some 3D quality.
No, that's correct. And in fact, the second slide that talked about perception in noise is partly for that reason. I mean, it's partly because you're improving the signal-to-noise ratio, but you're still relying on top-down processing. And I didn't talk too much about the fact that having the extra information is a big leap in top-down processing. But that's what Benefit 3 was. There was one line at the very bottom of the slide that talked about the fact that people who have one implant and don't do very well with that one implant have often done dramatically better with the second. That's that effect, exactly the effect you're talking about. Exactly that effect. And so, but initially, you see, when people didn't do well with their first implant, lots of people said, why bother with the second implant then? And so bravely, some people said, no, this can make a difference. And when they did implant these people, they had this dramatic improvement because of exactly what you say. It's not linear. It's not a situation of 1 + 1 = 2. It's 1 + 1 = 3 or 3.5 for some people. So it's exactly what you say. Absolutely, yes.
You have a question? So I was fascinated by your description that what you hear is the output of the CI convoluted by some sound memory or expectation of what a sound should be. Is there a distinction between old sounds and new sounds?
Well, yes. So I give you an example of this taken from music, for example. So when I lost my hearing, and I love music, I always love music, and lots of types of music too, but I lost my hearing a long, long time ago. So that means that when I listen to music, when I choose to listen to music, and I love to listen to it, I listen to music that is always from earlier than 1990.
That's good.
So, exactly. So some people say that's good because the music since then has been not so good. But I don't believe that. I'm sure there's great music, and I can't enjoy it in the same way because I can't use the musical memory. So to get around that problem, what you can do is listen to music that has interesting tempos or is fairly atonal. A lot of people with implantees who want to listen to music they've never heard before will listen to certain forms of progressive jazz, for example, because they sound absolutely wonderful in a cochlear implant, even though they probably don't sound anything like they would sound to the person that composed the music or was listening to it with you who could hear. So that's one aspect to this. There's another aspect which is very interesting, another psychophysical aspect, which is that I was lucky enough to have good relative pitch when I could hear. Now, not perfect pitch, but very good relative pitch. And so if I heard a piece of music, I could then sit at the piano and play it. And so because of that, I have a good memory of what a note should sound like. So now, if I sit at the piano with you, and you're going to do an experiment on me, you're going to strike middle C, let's say. But before you do so, I will close my eyes. So I close my eyes and you strike middle C. I have no idea what note you struck. If you then strike C sharp, I'll not know whether it's higher or lower, because I don't have the resolution to tell. However, If, on the other hand, I have my eyes open and watch you, when you strike C, it sounds exactly like C, always did. And when you strike C sharp, it sounds definitely higher. 5% higher than C. And so this is the musical, this is the memory, overwhelming what I'm actually perceiving at the time. And I cannot simply turn off the musical memory.
You know, Beethoven wrote his symphonies while deaf.
Yes, yes. There's a number of other famous examples of that as well, yes. That's an interesting comment. Yeah. Did that answer your question, though?
Sorry. I have a question with implants in children.
Yes.
I mean, how does this go? Because the children's head will grow at some point.
Well, that's a very good question. So, early on in the talk, I showed a picture of an excised human cochlea at 5 months gestation. And it turns out that the cochlea itself is full size at birth. That in itself is wonderfully convenient, right? Now, it's not surprising. If you look at a baby is a small thing, but look at the size of their head. Their head is not small. Their head is really quite big already. And it turns out the cochlea is fully formed. So the only complication is that although the cochlea is fully formed, so you can insert the electrodes at that age or shortly afterwards, it does not mean that the rest of the skull doesn't keep growing. And so one way to do that is to have a bit of slack in the electrodes. And that's what has been done in many cases, so that you don't have to come back in and implant again later. But the device itself is quite robust, and as long as you don't have a serious head injury or something that would damage the device as hardware, then it will. People believe it could last for 20 to 30 years. They haven't been around long enough yet to know how long they will last.
This is probably a personal question.
No.
Obviously, you learned to lip read very well when you were the family there.
Yeah.
As I know. But do you now use that also in conjunction?
That's a good question, yeah. Right.
Because obviously we now know how you hear because you just demonstrated
Right. So I find that in most cases I don't use lip reading anymore. But in cases where it's incredibly noisy, you're on a bus or some place where there's a lot of noise, and usually a place where hearing people having a great deal of difficulty understanding each other, I then find the lip reading turning back on. And I use that to give me an edge over my what I have of bionic hearing. And the combination of the two is very efficacious, and in fact creates a situation sometimes where I'm able to understand better what's being said than the hearing people. In a pub is another example. Yeah. But it's not something that I choose to do. It's involuntary, rather like breathing. It just starts to happen all on its own when I'm having trouble understanding. But as you also know, as a physicist, lip reading itself obeys an inverse square law. And so because of that, lip reading itself is only good from the kind of, you know, this distance here, lip reading would work. But from the back of the room, it would be impossible to lip read at the moment because you can see a person's face, but you can't see the subtle movement of the lips corresponding to individual words or phrases. And so it's of limit. So it tends to be in those kind of very close proximity settings where the sound source is very close, lots of background noise is there as well. Yeah. Anyway, that's the answer to the question. Yeah.
So I now know what I have to do when I go to the pub.
That's right.
There was a question up there. Nick.
Going back to the musical memory issue.
Yeah.
When you hear people's voices for the first time, for example, you're hearing your daughter's voice for the first time, how does that sound? Are you able to...
Well, that's a very good question. So, I mean, that day, the actual day that I'll tell you the story in a little bit more detail. So, after, when I was actually, when my hearing came back in the audiologist's office, I was with people I'd never met before except the surgeon who was there from the day of the surgery, and I know him very well personally because he was an academic colleague. The nurses and other audiologists I'd never met before, so I'm hearing these voices. But because I don't know what they should sound like, they're just voices. And I did know a little bit about what I could expect if I did hear. And one of the things I knew was that when the electrode is inserted into the cochlea, it cannot reach all the way to the apex. And because of that, the stimulation of the auditory nerve is preferentially towards higher frequencies, which are physiologically at the base. And so the effect is called tonotropic shift. And it means that the sound will be higher than it would normally be. And so these people sounded quite high-pitched, but then many of them were women. I didn't know their voices anyway. But then I get back to my university, so it's late in the afternoon when I get back, and there's nobody there except one guy who's a physicist, and I won't say who it is, but it's someone that some of you in this room probably know. And he's a guy, an English guy, with a fairly deep voice. And he knew that I'd been getting my activation, so he was very keen to know how it had gone. So he said, "How did it go?" And what I heard was a voice that sounded like Minnie Mouse. So I said, "What happened to you?" and he looked at me like, you know, "What do you mean, what happened to me?" But I realized at that moment, I really felt this tonotopic shift, this dramatic increase in the frequency. This guy sounded like a soprano. And yet he was a big guy, and he's not the kind of guy you'd expect to have a soprano voice. Now, of course, I now get home, and I see my wife. The next person I saw was my wife. But I know her voice so well from before I was deaf. What I heard was her beautiful Italian accent, just the way it always was. And then, now comes the moment when I get to hear my daughter, and I know how children are supposed to sound, high-pitched. And of course, this tonotopic shifting was making the voices high-pitched. So she sounded like a high-pitched, sort of vaguely transatlantic voice, which is what she has, I'm told. You know, so it's like, that was what I had, but I had no musical memory. And so I just know it has to be a girl of 11, so fairly high-pitched voice. She's grown up in the United States, but spent every summer in Europe since she was born. And so her voice is not as, is a Midwestern accent, but not a very strong one. More like a sort of, more transatlantic, a little bit UK, a little bit US. And that's what she had. And it sounded great. I gave her Dylan Thomas, it was Christmas time almost, so I gave her Dylan Thomas's Charles Christmas in Wales to read to me. Because, you know, you wonder what to say to each other. You know, of course you say how much you love each other, but then you've got to actually say more. I mean, what are you supposed to say? She didn't know what to do, so I gave her a book to read. "Read to me," I said, and she read to me Dylan Thomas's Charles Christmas in Wales, which is a short and very beautiful book, and she read it so well. And that was very emotional. I mean, it's a very difficult thing to describe, because partly it was very emotional, and not really objective. But then, the end of the story is that the next morning, I go to work, expecting to hear this guy with the high-pitched soprano voice, and it was just sounded awful the first day, and I really didn't want to go through that again. I get to work, and now, a few hours later, we're going to leave and go to Europe for the holidays. So I get to work, and expecting all these men physicists that I work with to have these high-pitched voices, and they're all renormalized, they were all normal. And so overnight, the brain had said, "Get rid of all this tonotopic shifting, people sound normal." So that's, does that answer your question?
I think there was one more question here.
So you said that for adults who heard before, so they were not born deaf, that after the implant, that there's lots of the previous memory, the visual, audition, everything. And for children, that doesn't happen so easily because they don't have that memory in place.
Right.
But even as an adult, you said you've been deaf for 10 years plus. After you had the implants and they were activated, did you have to learn new things? Apart from adapting to the difference in the sounds, like vocabulary or expressions, gestures?
But the things that I learned that I had to go and learn again were environmental sounds that didn't seemed to relate in any way to what I knew before. And the first of those happened within 24 hours of getting activated, because my daughter at the time was learning to play the viola. And I'd obviously never heard a viola through a cochlear implant, and I'm walking down the stairs hearing a very strange and very unpleasant sound, wondering what it is, turn the corner, and there's my daughter playing the viola the next morning before school. And so you say, okay, that's what a viola sounds like. So what you actually do for the first few days is you go around collecting sounds. You know, you knock on something and listen to what it sounds like, because you can't use the contextual interpretations that you use with language to help you with something like that. You have to actually collect the sounds again. And so you take a coin, you rub it against something, you crinkle up a piece of paper. All the kind of environmental sounds you're normally exposed to, you have to relearn. And that comes very quickly, because you've done it before. And because the adult brain is still remarkably plastic. Now, although children have a hard time to understand language through a cochlear implant, they have an advantage, though, is that if they're implanted very young indeed, that's a time when they would be learning language anyway. And so they have much more plasticity and ability to learn than we do as adults. And for that reason, there's a compensation factor. And so that's why some children can do very well with a cochlear implant. However, they must be placed in a very supportive environment to do that.
Has enough time passed for those children who could now be adults to compare if they are at, for example, your level, because you had heard before?
Yeah.
Is it possible to compare it now or not yet?
Well, I think it's hard to do that at the moment because, first of all, the really effective multi-electrode devices were coming in around the year 2000. And many of the children that were implanted, at least in the United States, were not 6 months of age, which was believed to be the best time to implant them. They were often implanted somewhat later. Also, initially, it wasn't realized that the other aspects of the support of the patient were important. And so in some cases, they didn't get the adequate support. In some cases, they've done very well. But there's only very few people at the moment. But I've met some young people who are now roughly, I guess, well, let's say if they were implanted in 2000 and they were, let's say, a year of age then, and they're 14 now. I've met a few people like that and they seem to do very well. But it is very, very difficult to get the kind of data that we're used to having as scientists, at least as physicists, because you're dealing with people and relatively small groups of people and often dispersed around the globe. And there are many other issues that come into play. For example, if the data is collected by a cochlear implant company, they're probably quite keen to emphasize the success. On the other hand, if you're an insurance company in the US trying to minimize cost, you might emphasize the cases that weren't so successful. And so we don't have a complete picture of the exact success rates, but all the indicators are that if done right, optimally, with the right amount of support, a young person who's born deaf can become a fully functioning adult with hearing.
Thank you.
Okay.
I think we should bring this to a close, so let's thank Ian.
Thank you. Thanks very much.